you saw, maybe some of the things I was talking about, or some of the images, you know, whatever you'd like to share or talk about, you know, welcome any kinds of questions that I might be able to help with. So yeah, any comments, questions, reflections, or things I can clarify further for you?
I'll just start off, but I know all the graduates they definitely have questions, but I'm just curious about that little exchange you had with Esteb Mendez when she said, I don't quite agree with the interpretation, but it's okay, it's you. Could you just kind of address that a little bit?
Because in a way that kind of has to do with like the ethics of how you work with someone, right? That was for an image that was published in another essay. It was an essay, and it was an image called La Ofrenda. Some of you may be familiar with it. It's an image from behind of a woman, and she has a kind of a buzz cut, a little bit of a buzz cut mohawk, and there's a hand that to me looks pretty feminine, you know. So it's a very butchy image of a woman, and then a hand that is also gender ambiguous in my view, extending a rose to both the Virgen de Guadalupe on the back of the woman, and also to the woman herself. It's ambiguous. We don't know to who is the rose being offered, or is it to both? The Virgen de Guadalupe. And she's also, by the way, the image is a very indigenous butchie, Virgen de Guadalupe. So I said that, and you know, I said, so I think it's very butchie and very gender bending. And she said she didn't necessarily agree. But she said it's fine, you can interpret it as much. That's how I saw it, you know, don't put in them. And so I remember that got me thinking about, like, a light bulb went off my head, like, oh, La Virgen, a woman who knows no man. But that doesn't mean she can't know women. And I thought that's what she was kind of working with. So in that case, she was fine with my writing, you know, about whatever I wanted to. I did have another artist told me explicitly, I worked with one of the artist's images interested me because I thought that she was an artist for whom the altar was about the sacrificial slab, you know? And because I thought her images were a lot about suffering and unwilling sacrifice. And I found powerful, and I wrote about that. And she didn't have any problem at all with my interpretation, but she didn't want me. She wanted people to remember her images that she felt were more healed, that were more powerful and healing, and I totally respected that. And so I talked about how I felt that, you know, what I thought was going on in the work. I thought there was a lot of repressed sexual violence in the domestic sphere. Because, you know, and I explained that when I discussed the work, because that's what I powerfully felt was happening there, you know. And I don't think it was just a projection. If you read that section, you know, you don't have the images in there, but I tell you where you can go with the images. But I did, you know, I took very seriously what she was saying, and so I did talk about some of her work and how it evolved. You know, how her later work is about, in fact, control within the domestic space. The domestic space isn't scary anymore, and she starts using geometric grids, like the tablecloth, are now very smooth, pleasant, the windows open, and the air is billowing, and you can see the ocean. And it's a calming space. It isn't a frightening space, because the other interiors were just frightening. Everything was sharp, there was blood red everywhere. You know, the tablecloths were like skirts being pulled up, and it was very, you know, it was very clear that there was a lot happening. And so it made total sense to talk about a phase, you know, in her work, which was more healed. I also tried to share with a lot of the artists what I wrote, remember that? Because I felt like I wanted their feedback. It didn't mean, I was trying to figure out a kind of a way to do this. That was not about, you know, I want to, well, what it was about was like, you know, does this make sense to you? You know, do you think that I'm like going too far out in my interpretations? Is there something you want to add? So there was enough time to have those kinds of exchanges. It was a really good thing because in many cases people corrected, you know, some little detail that was off or enriched. And a lot of my writing, a lot of what I write about is totally, and I say that in the footnotes, wherever an artist like informed a lot of what I know about the piece, I, you know, say that because that was part, that's how I collect the knowledge that I didn't have myself, in part. So, yeah.
How did you go about choosing what artists you were going to include in your book?
Well, I looked at a lot of images, you know, like most artists were really generous, and like they would send me like the maximum, you know, number of slides, which was fantastic, it was wonderful, you know. I'm not sure, I'm really not sure. I think, you know, I say in the book that I think it was a little bit idiosyncratic, you know, like I'm not really sure what the logic, the conscious logic was. But except to tell you that I feel that the images that I chose, I thought were really, really powerful. Now, there was the work of an artist that that I also liked, and that came very late, you know, as a suggestion to the book. By then, I was totally exhausted and dead. And I didn't have the chapters were this big, and I had no idea where I would stop. But when I look at the work, I know that the artist is working with spirituality. I can see that. And I know that the artist is also very informed by indigeneity, which is also, you know, important. It didn't have to be the only kind of spirituality. But I just didn't really feel that the way in which she was working with any of that was adding something different than what had already been brought to the book. But maybe if I'd started with her, it would have been different. I don't know, you know? And so I think, and then I'll add something, also be very frank. That artist in particular, I mean, not only did I not think it was bringing anything, you know, to what was already being put out there, it just didn't move me the same way. It didn't grab me the same way. It wasn't, to me, powerful, even though I really respect the body of this person's work. And likewise, you know, I don't know, it's what I found really powerful and intriguing, you know, because like, I looked at so much work for most of the artists, so it was the stuff that, from my point of view, kind of needed a lot of, allowed for a lot of thinking with and thinking through. Yeah. So that's why I say very explicitly at the beginning, it is not a history, it is not art, you know. But I think, and nor does it represent all Chicana artists, nor does it pretend, you know, to be authoritative, nor does it try to suggest that all Chicana artists are spiritual or that these are the most spiritual. It doesn't. I don't pretend any of that. But it is definitely a slice, you know, of both spiritual thinking or thinking about spirituality as well as aesthetic thinking. You know, it's a piece of history, but it's a much bigger piece. There are many more Chicana artists that are working in these roles too.
I was kind of curious, in the introduction you talk about like Dadaist and Surrealist work, and how you see them sort of related in terms of, you know, calling into question, oppressive systems, you know, how they're subversive, and you related to that. I was wondering if you could talk more to that, because I see how you bring in an example like of the Asco, the walking mural, where you know, an element of spirituality is brought into an avant-garde piece. But I'm thinking about, like, the avant-garde Chicano practices as spiritual in themselves. And I'm wondering if you had any thoughts on that. Not just bringing in spiritual elements, but how those practices, and maybe relating it to, if you are talking about, like, Dadaist or Surrealist practices, are those spiritual in a similar way, or are they? Is it just that they're subversive and they're related? You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, my dissertation, I looked at that period of time, and I looked at Nicaragua. You know, but what I was always interested, the reason I looked at that period of time, and I did look a lot at the visual artists at that time, was because I was interested in the relationship between art and politics. And when I found out about those first four decades, right, and I began in Latin America. You know, looking at the first four decades of the 1900s in Latin America and all the ismos there, you know, all the like revolutionary artistic movements that happened to also be revolutionary politically, generally the left, but there were also the right, which is why I studied the Nicaraguan case and everything we did. I was fascinated with how those, so then I moved to study in Europe because they moved there, they were dialoguing, they were influenced with, you know, I mean, Picasso's kind of late a little bit in the game, and so they were interested in all those isms. And what I was fascinated by is the fact that whether it was right or left, and it was generally right or left as opposed to, you know, anything like kind of more the middle, liberal, you know, so kind of radical, definitely. I was just interested in how artists were struggling for their power at that moment too, and to try to have an influence in society and to have something to say about it. They looked at their lives. This is where like Dada kind of comes in. Also, like, is this important site for both artistic action and political action? That's what fascinated me about that period. It's not necessary, and therefore, they were willing to make experiments with visuality, the art history they received, but also with politics, either really right or left, and trying to be what Gramsci called organic intellectuals, you know, like these living, totally connected intellectuals with society to have an impact and a say. In the case of Nicaragua, they unfortunately were successful because they influenced the Somoza dictatorship, which was really interesting, but they thought that was the direction to go. In most cases, it was the other direction, supporting different communist governments, and then maybe they were backing out, actually. So that's all that interested me, you know? I was interested in that profound belief that everything that we do matters politically, and that what we do, our lives, can also be very artistic and aesthetic in the deep sense of that word, you know? And so I think that that's shared, and also this willingness to criticize the dominant cultural languages, because that's what those you know, the futurists, the surrealists, the Dadaists, those people were really willing to take the art history they were trained in and shop it and do something different. Why? The point, and this is the big question for me, the reason they did that is because they felt it was necessary, because they felt they had to shake people off. They didn't do it just because they wanted to be shocking. But when they were shocking, shock bourgeoisie, it's when they used shock techniques, it was because they felt that they had to shock people out of wanting to expect entertainment, you know, but not thought, right? So that was similar, right? That willingness to be critical with the received art historical traditions. In the case of the Chicanas, if you look at like Yolanda's work and all the early people in the Guadalupe work, I think that's the very same spirit of being able to take a visual culture, whether it's Mexican popular culture, Mexican religious visual culture, the Sacred Virgen, they're willing to take that and do something supposedly irreverent, but not for the sake of irreverence, but for the sake of trying to shift our perspective, shock us into thinking differently, right? Taking the familiar and introducing a change. So there's a reason for that. And so after those first four decades in the 1900s, it gets old and boring and everyone starts to do it. So like, what does avant-garde mean, cutting edge? At that time, that's what that meant, and I saw it happening again in the 60s and the 70s, you know. So it's not, you know, because I felt it was very fresh and very authentic to both of those moments, you know, that irreverence with respect to the artistic and cultural holy cows that they felt were bankrupt. It deeply influenced both of those. So you know, like what was when I was in school, so the surrealists and the Dadaists and all these people are well recognized, they're the holy cows, right? And I felt like, because that was where most of my training was, and I looked at this work and I said, that's what's going on here. This is the avant-garde right now. This is the avant-garde, and why don't they see that? Everything else seemed to me really like tame or just boring or decorative, and I go, what they're doing is so experimental and so brave, where experimental means something. It's not just I'm going to shock you because look how experimental, but it was necessary as a tactic, it seemed to me. Yeah. Any other questions or thoughts, ideas?
I didn't read the end of the book yet.
Okay.
I just got it in the mail yesterday.
The last, only read the last. I read the last chapter.
I read the first chapter, but I noticed that you wrote about Srimadaya's The Hungry Woman.
Yeah.
And Srimadaya's, I believe, is writing about kind of having a vision of Chicano politics as it's playing out. And I'm curious how you connected The Hungry Woman to Chicana art. How you're connecting art and literature towards the end of the book.
The Hungry Woman is in the chapter that is on land theater. And so what happened is the way that the chapters came together, like when I said about Agdades, for example, some are like, you know, Agdades, Agdades. They're like, you know, Agdades. others are like, it seems to me, they're like photographic and filmic effects. And I don't think I'm stretching it. I think I'm thinking about what's an attack, and I think that it's functioning that way to work, right? So there are different kinds of things in our bodies, including an attack work, right? And including a three-piece, the Venus and the installation. I think of that also. I mean, it's based on a goddess. So anyway, the idea is it's not that there are different genres. There are different media, different kinds of art forms that are using a similar idea to structure itself, like get back, or a similar concept that fascinates them. And so that's what ended up the chapter. So it could be different kinds of art forms, film, painting, drawing, comic book. What mattered is, for example, in the Atat chapter, that it was like that. In the chapter on Vieira Land, that was a chapter that that dealt with how so many different art forms, whether it's creative writing, whether it's plays, you know, whether it's spoken word, whether it's art books, you know, whether it's different kinds of, whatever, different sorts of art, but that work was concerned with the question of land, you know, art tierra, and so it has to do with, like, obviously the 1848, you know, war, you know, the seizure of Mexican land. But, you know, that whole thing about occupation, you know, the seizure and occupation of the land, and people like Shirley Moraga is also related to how we are occupied, how our bodies are made. Shirley has spent a lot of time thinking about how the war is in our flesh, and as she says, all of the war is in the bedroom. The war is in bed, right? She's a queer Chicano writer, and so she is deeply concerned with the question of Aslan. But Aslan is not disconnected, right, from how we live. You know, the kinds of colonizations of the land are reflected in the colonizations of our lives, of our sexualities, and our relations between each other in Aslan and among Chicanos. So the hungry woman is, the hungry woman is very quickly, it's about the future. She sets this play in the future after Aslan has been regained by a Chicano revolution. And in it, all of the quote-unquote undesirables are sent to Phoenix, Arizona, Donatello, right? And they're used to make the revolution happen, and then the reassertion of a Hispanic void, you know, Europeanoid, more of a Mexican, you know, Hispanism, and straightness. And so they're thrown out, right? All the undesirables, you know, and they're sexually undesirable because they're unwilling to be part of the patriarchy. So she really makes us think about what kind of Aslan do we want? And it doesn't have to mean, it doesn't have to be the literal Aslan, like let's take the land in Southwest France. For some people it is literal. But the point is that we're imagining together a civil rights movement as people did in the 60s and 70s, right? And then some ways still continue. It's like our shared culture of resistance to racism, you know, and of a better values. If that's Aslan, a shared intellectual, ideological, spiritual, political project, right, of culture and politics, then that's not enough. Because what is the basis for this unity? And God forbid we should actually take the land back and patriarchy and Spanish Eurocentrism, you know, be reasserted. And so that's her very deep, you know, meditation on the ongoing homophobia and sexism within the Chicano movement. You know? So it's about land, and she makes it very obvious in that play. You know, on the question of the land, the question of racism and colonialism is not disconnected from the ways in which our bodies and our sexualities are colonized by sexism and homophobia. And they actually come to us, by the way, through the European colonization. So it's not just a metaphor that works well if we're colonized by people's ideas of sexuality and gender, but in fact we're colonized by that set of ideas, which isn't to say that there weren't societies that seem to have also been male-dominant in the Americas. There's still a lot of people doing that work, and people with Chicanos have been one of the first to criticize what seems to have been the kind of patriarchy that the Aztecs had, but it seems that women were much more empowered, and I think the daily system shows that, right? But anyway, yeah, it's just that question of really deeply thinking, what is it that people that we are fighting for? What is it that we think unites us? Why should we get sentimental about being Chicanos? You know, what is it, I mean, as the audience on West Sat and Borderlands, you know, if her people can't approve, or all her peoples, the indigenous peoples, the Mexicano peoples, the white peoples, all the cultures that shape her, even if she wasn't white, but her culture, then just forget it. I don't know the loyalty of that. And I think that's what Sheree is reasserting. We, you know, our loyalty is to what we think is right, you know, not to some sentimental notion of race or culture or nationalism. You know, our duty is to tell each other the truth. And not to sacrifice those things for after the revolution, which is what the left did traditionally all over. The world after the revolution will deal with gender. Forget sex, sexuality. They don't forget sex, but sexuality. Heterosex, there's a lot of heterosex. There's a lot of imprisoned queer sex.
Well, you mentioned at the beginning of your project that you went to the African American community, which we have first become in the closing sense was that they're not writing to the Invisible One critic, they're writing for each other. Right now, in child studies and child literature, is that that environment that exists for African Americans, I don't think it exists for Chinese. It doesn't leave the level.
That we're able to write for each other?
Yeah, in the sense that community that exists is as strong as an African community. Because in a sense, at the beginning of the project, you look somewhere else for support for your own project. You couldn't look into our community for that. You went somewhere else for support. As opposed to...
Oh, no, no. I think that part of what happened for me with the Chicano community is that it was being worked on by the artists. I think they were cutting that edge first. And I think some people were writing, like, you know, some authors have gone to the spirituality, right? There were people, you know, and of course, Sheree, Victoria were writing, right? So there were people who were thinking about it, creating community. When I first wrote, the first thing I ever did on spirituality, there was only one book review. There was two different buildings on the spirituality. There were probably, you know, I think there were I was in Peru and in Bolivia, and I met a guy who had come down from the mountains. He had been studying with Iset, the reborn Inca, the reborn priest. And, so they believe the Aymara Quechua, the traditional Aymara Quechua, believe that this is the time of the rebirth of the spiritual teachers, that they're coming back, being seated, that they're being born, you know, among us. So, a ver, right? So I think it's changing, is what I'm saying. There's a new zeitgeist out there.
In the future, if you plan for your business, so like, if you have time, I guess, and the energy to write another book, if you plan for your business, this whole thing of, I think you call it the Diaphrasis, or the two worldviews are invoking, you yoke two things together to look the third one. And that's something that I just thought was very interesting. And I thought that in that sense,
maybe
you use also miniature and major photography, other fields, other, you know.
Yeah.
Do you plan to write another book?
There's three people I want to say who turned me on to the diaphragm, and one was someone that they're reading in Elena's class right now. David Carrasco spoke about the Bicracismo, the great defender of the indigenous people, anthropologist, literary personality, Elena Portilla. He wrote about Bicracismo. And then my colleague, the poet Alfred Arteaga, wrote about Bicracismo. Those three people are the ones who were like, wow, check it out, Bicracismo, it's amazing, it's cool. They're the ones who turned me on to it. And so that, you know, I don't think right now I'm gonna like work on that because it's really big. I would love to go study pictographs and stuff, and I don't think it's gonna happen right now. What I'm working on right now and I'm beginning to work on is the question of what I want to understand better is hybridity. I want to understand spiritual hybridity better. I want to understand it because the language that we have inherited to think about hybridity is the language of empire. It's the language of the imperialist anthropologist, syncretism. And there are theories that we have received that everybody, that's why everybody thinks we're like nostalgic when we look to the past, the indigenous or African or whatever. There are theories thrown to themselves. They said that the colonization came and totally broke the back of it, every coherent explanation of reality. And so that all we were left with were fragments, you know. And I think that clearly that is a very Eurocentric narrative about, like, give it up. Most of it is gone. You know, at best, we have a few pieces, and that's cool and good, and let's incorporate it. But a lot more survive than that. And I think the people who work on folk Catholicism, for example, have been on to that. I mean, the priests during the 1800s, still to the present, you know, where there are rural communities that are practicing very strange forms of Catholicism, right, folk Catholicism, they know that that stuff is not Christian, you know. It's like my mother putting, like, water under the bed. There's a mala creación. Or, like, you know, putting a tomato around the house or anything. She's like, so how broken can it be if most of us know what to drink when we have stomach aches, when we've had a susto? If all of us know what susto is to some degree or the other, es que esta niña tuvo un susto, you know? How broken can it be? And Celia Herrera Rodriguez, actually all the women who have been working on the indigenous have taught me so much about this. But Celia Herrera Rodriguez, the performance artist who's the painter that who did that kind of funny book party in LA, in that piece, part of what she's saying, what she's pointing out is, we don't have to act like exotic Indians, and we don't have to be guilty about the fact that our grandmother doesn't speak the language, or we don't speak the language, because what Celia says is, the indigenous has been recoded. And I read that about African sangria and other forms of African spirituality, how they consciously said, okay, Santa Barbara, you are going to be Shango. I'm going to mass, no problem, you know? But when nobody's watching, we're going to do this, you know, let's dress you in red and black, and let's do it. So people know that about the African, and I think that there, with respect to the indigenous in Latin America, and I'm not too sure about the North, because I know less about the Northern Native peoples, but I want to know a lot more about the Native. So I just think that language, that we really have to think about that. What does it mean? You know, this question, how our people survive, and how in this mestizaje, indigeneity survives. Because as Irena pointed out in one of her pieces, which was for the Sphinx Venus thing, Like, yeah, the Turquoise Turquesa, so she did that with an anti-immigrant sentiment, and her point in that piece, among other things, was that the peoples of the Americas have always circulated on the continent, right? So she showed turquoise and jade being found by anthropologists. So migration across the border, well, today's the border, is no news for anyone. And that set me thinking about how when you study world history, that's not always is. There are always traders. And there are always people who are interested in knowing. And they're always adventurers and open-minded. So they go and find out a new custom and they bring it back. And, you know, so there's nothing, we don't have to be traditional. We don't have to, you know, and we can change. We can say, I'm totally traditional, but this is boring. Let's do something new. I like what those people are doing over there. Because they're not, as the Northern Native people have taught me a little bit, I've learned about them, is that, you know, the dead Indian and the stereotype of the Indian is not, it's ahistorical. That too is a creation of the imperialist. Because Indian people are always in motion, always changing like any people. And so doesn't that make sense that, like, you know, the way that people chose to preserve their spirituality, how many people could be in your house checking your spirituality? You know, what you did there, it's just not possible, right? And so the altares, the tradition of the altares that we all have, is people say, when like, oh, well, my mother never had an altar, we weren't raised religious. But when you start digging around, there's no yan, the TV set, my mom at the top of, you know, a little dresser, these little makeshift altares, what is really sacred to us, our religion, our family, whatever it is. And so people have done studies about the altares that show that this was the site of resistance. Women used to be priests in the indigenous world, in the Latin American indigenous world, in the Navajo world. And so the way they dealt with male-centered Christianity with a male god is by the practices of the altares in their houses, where they did whatever they wanted, and the priest in the house was either the grandmother or the, you know, whoever. And very often women is what I'm saying. So a notion of empowered female spirituality was happening in people's houses and survives to our day. So it's a not encroaching, you know, because I'm fascinated by that question of, you know, hybridity and how today we cut and paste what we feel like it. And part of my insight has come from, like, what does it matter if I got it from African Sandia or Buddhism? When the day is done, it's the politics and spirituality that I care about. And maybe that's partly the way that people do think, you know, who are not afraid and who are not just traditional or obedient. You know, so I don't know. So I want to think more about the secretism. I want to learn more about it, because to me right now it's still, I feel like this old thing that, you know, there's so much more to learn.